And I will now call the second case on today's oral argument calendar. That is case number A20-1583, Trevor Hogan versus O'Loughlin Trucking and Excavating Mechanical LLC. As you know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. And relators Council will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. You should be able to see the time clock on your screen if you're using a gallery view or some view such as that. So, Council for Relator, you may begin by introducing yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Carl Sonneman. I'm an attorney at law with offices in Winona, Minnesota. My client is Trevor Hogan. I believe he is observing as permitted by the court. He will not appear on screen, as I understand it. The issue in this case can be stated fairly simply, and this is one of several issues, but it is the principal issue that stands before the court. The issue is, did or did not the executive order 2020-05 suspends strict compliance with the exceptions to the ineligibility for quitting employment. If strict compliance is suspended, then it becomes necessary to determine what is substantial compliance.
Mr. Sonneman, let me start with that. And let's assume that that is the primary issue before us, as he's put it. I wasn't clear from the briefs what impact specifically a change from strictly complying to substantially complying would have on the good cause exception. So if you formulate it in the way we have under strict compliance, I guess you would say that the good cause exception means that the ULJ would determine whether the employer treated Hogan in a manner that would compel a reasonable person to quit. So what changed to that formulation? Does moving from strict to is it change reasonable person to a subjective standard? Does it change the verb compel instead of compelling a reasonable person to quit? Does it instead mean that it provides a less desirable employment environment? Or so I guess I'm struggling with what is the rule of law that you want us to apply, if not that formulation of the good cause exception?
I think that the good cause exception in the circumstances we have, which is the COVID pandemic, becomes less than a strict reading of events and circumstances surrounding the individual employee and the individual employer. We know that COVID was a pervasive, invasive virus that was coming at us in a way we didn't fully understand. And what I would argue that the good cause becomes recognizing it at the start that COVID, and I'll use the words from the Ferguson case, COVID is real, not imaginary, substantial, not trifling, and reasonable, not whimsical as a reason for quit. The circumstances surrounding the quit essentially says that if the fear of COVID should have been enough in the circumstances to allow substantial compliance with good cause. It moves.
One of the questions that I had, just to piggyback on Judge Bryan's question, is the position that you're taking really that the fear of contracting COVID in the workplace is always good cause?
I've thought about this a lot, I'll be honest. And in the context of March 2020, the last several weeks of March, maybe the first several weeks of April, I think it almost has to be.
So for everybody, not just for your client, but for everybody who decided that I'm afraid that I'm going to contract COVID in the workplace and therefore I'm going to quit my job, that's good cause?
I think that it, yes, I think that it is good cause.
Is that is that something that the legislature should have, or maybe the executive order should have stated more clearly and not be left to us to decide?
That's a dilemma that courts constantly face, I realize. The answer I'd have is the legislature did not have the time and opportunity to consider it. I mean, this was literally rolling down day by day.
Mr. Sonnenman, I'd like to take you back to the formulation of what the good cause exception should be. I understand how it's difficult to pinpoint, and one way to define it is to make it subjective. If this particular person was afraid, then therefore that's enough. But I'm asking you to tell us, what is the law that you want us to apply? If in fact the executive order changes the requirements of the good cause exception, what does it change it to mean? Are we changing reasonable to subjective? Are you changing compelled to something less than compel? I want you to tell us the legal rule that you're asking us to apply here so that we can make our review.
I think the difficulty I have in explaining it, I think the difficulty that is there is that if you use words like reasonable or you use words like compel and you apply that terminology, that understanding to COVID, the circumstances of COVID as they existed in the last several weeks of March, they apply. I mean, it was compelling. It was a reasonable act for someone to say.
So, Mr. Sonnenman, what you're now saying, Mr. Sonnenman, what you're now saying is that there should be no change to the standards or the requirements of good cause. What you're now saying is that because of COVID, it was reasonable. And we're applying the same reasonable person standard, the same compel language. There was no change. And under the standard that is, as has always been there, you just are asking for a different result. And that's why I'm asking these questions, so I know what it is you want us to apply to the circumstances here. And if what you are saying, in fact, is that it is a reasonable decision for somebody to make, a reasonable person would have made that same decision. A reasonable person would still have felt compelled to quit. Then we're not changing the standard of review at all.
I think that the thing, what it does is two things. It takes the language of the governor's order, which says that strict compliance is suspended. And it, I think in the end, it makes it more subjective. Reasonable becomes more subjective in the circumstances. Compel becomes more subjective. It removes the individualism that is required in the relationship between the employer and the employee. We have to be honest. We know that the employers did not cause COVID. They did not bring COVID into the state, into their community, into the workplace. But at the same time, we can't hold employees to a higher standard that they must continue in the face of this fearful and dangerous disease, and not give them latitude. Essentially, it gives the employee greater latitude to make a decision that we've often said is, if you look at the steps, is you're supposed to first inform the employer about the problem, give the employer an opportunity to accommodate the problem. And it's those elements that are really being suspended, it's obvious that everyone knew of COVID. You don't have to tell the employer it's present. There are discussions in the workplace here, which could be interpreted that way, but I don't think we want the substantial compliance versus strict compliance would allow us to simply move forward from generalities in that context, number one. Number two, what is an accommodation? The most appropriate accommodation that we know of in March is to stay at home. It took about 10 days to move from the 05 order to the 20-20 order, which ordered people to stay at home. But the conditions, the circumstances that were driving that order, and frankly, we could say the drafting of that order, was taking place over the events of those days and with recognition of what was happening. And if an employee took a look at this, you know, essentially viewed the circumstances much in the same way the governor was looking at them, and I think that's a totally reasonable judgment, one would say the accommodation is to allow the employee to stay at home. And when none of that was recognized here, the employee had the, I think that justifies the employee to exercise the role of quit. And, that's the same problem you get into with the other exception, the medical exception, that if you take it through the reason that the strict compliance rules of how that's applied, you find the same problems of notice, opportunity to remedy. And under the context of COVID, a much looser approach to reviewing those steps, reviewing whether there's notice, determining what is an accommodation, and removing some of the substantial part of the individualism that is in the strict understanding of those rules needs to be applied. It's consistent with what the statute says, but it is certainly much that in the context of what we mean by substantial compliance, but it is certainly not the strict compliance that has been interpreted going forward. Or going, looking to the past. I mean,
Mr. Sonneman, what the governor later, 2 months later, I believe in May of 2020, issued Executive Order 20-54, which I think spoke more specifically to this situation. Even then, under the good reason exception, I think the modification was relatively modest or slight. I guess it seems less dramatic than what you're suggesting we should, how we should interpret the earlier executive order, which I think was -04. So I guess, is the later executive order -54 relevant to our interpretation of the earlier executive order 0.04 and our resolution of your argument?
If I might correct, it was 0.05 or -05.
Okay, thank you.
That's the order. Only in the context of a passage of time. I mean, as I indicated, the circumstances of March are different than the circumstances of May. And as we look at the progression of orders under the overriding umbrella of the declaration the crisis declaration. What we see is a growing recognition, growing understanding of what is COVID, how it works, what we can do about it. And I think that if it added, I think it's as much written in the context of we know more about it. We're not as much in the mode of we don't know what we're dealing with. It is terrible. It is causing these, hospitalizations, deaths, and people are reacting to that. And I think less strict, a looser standard in March is certainly consistent with tightening that in May without believing that the May tightening of it relates back to March. And I would argue that there's more latitude in March to give latitude to an individual who based upon their fears and their understanding of COVID, the danger here is to view quit in the context that the law essentially does, which is a moment of someone walking into the office and saying, I quit. you look at the circumstances of this case, and it's very ambiguous what a quit was and whether a quit occurred on March 23 or actually did not occur that day. And if anything occurred later in April, April 22nd would be the trigger date there.
Mr. Sonneman, I'm sorry. I have, maybe you're not done with answering my question, but I have one more question before time expires. In the statutory definition of good reason caused by the employer, one of the requirements is that the good reason is something for which the employer is responsible. Yes. So if the reason here is the pandemic, is that something for which the employer is responsible?
The answer is no in simple terms, but that is one of the areas where strict compliance, I think, needs to be examined and recognized as suspended, because it may be that the employer's reactions to COVID. I mean, there's nothing in the record that indicates the employer had a reaction or had a plan for dealing with it. They certainly didn't have a COVID compliance plan, as would be later required. And you know, you could try and hold the employer responsible in that way, but I'm not really trying to say that. I'm saying basically everybody was in the same boat at that point in time. And if we, in order to protect the employee, we may have to suspend that, the strictness of the employer's responsibility, and give recognize what was actually happening. And it's hard to think of another example we've had in our lifetime that comes close to this. So I guess that's, you know, where I would take that.
Okay, Mr. Sonneman, your initial allotment of time has expired. Unless another judge has a question for you now, I will turn to respondents' counsel, and then you will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Phillips, you may introduce yourself and your client and proceed.
All right, thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I represent a respondent, Department of Employment and Economic Development, or DEED. So Relator seems to concede that he doesn't meet the quit exceptions as they are written. He argues that under Executive Order 2005, any person who quits due to a fear of COVID in the early days of the pandemic is eligible for unemployment benefits. And that is inconsistent with the governor's orders. In Murak, which is the published case that we have on substantial compliance, the court held that an applicant must substantially comply with the appeal deadline, which is a procedural issue. And they gave us a test for that. We have a test for substantial compliance. But the court has not ruled on the standard for anything that is not procedural, kind of like the substantive quit exceptions here. But even if the court determines that substantial compliance test does apply here, the evidence shows that when the relator quit on March 23rd, he had not taken any steps to comply with the requirements of the quit exceptions, and he did not have a reasonable explanation for failing to strictly comply.
So, Ms. Phillips, if I can interrupt, because I think there's a threshold question here too. As I review the letters, the transcript, the request for reconsideration, I don't see a point at which Relator argued that there is a suspension of strict compliance or mentioned the impact of the executive order at all. And so I guess my question is, do you believe that that's forfeited?
That's a good question. And I didn't argue that in my brief. It wasn't brought up below. So I believe it is forfeited. He didn't mention it in the request for reconsideration, I believe. He mentions it for the first time in this appeal. So in that regard, the argument wasn't made.
There are times when we're talking about issues of law where this court properly does consider them. So that's more where I'm going. I didn't see it in there. So typically we would say you can't bring a new argument for the first time, but where it is more of a purely legal one. There are circumstances when we might address it. So maybe you could speak to that too.
Sure. So I'll start with looking at the governor's orders and kind of addressing relator's argument about the orders. So in Murek, the court held that the appeal deadline still stands, that there's a substantial compliance, but it didn't do away with it. And likewise, the governor's orders indicate that the quit exceptions still stand. They are not eliminated. The requirements are not eliminated. I'll start with 2005. So this is the one where the governor suspended strict compliance with 268, but he also provided some changes to the substantive law, including that a leave of absence will be presumed to be involuntary if certain criteria are met. So notably here, even if relator did not quit and was on a leave of absence, he would not meet that criteria in the executive order for an involuntary leave of absence because he didn't have a recommendation by a healthcare professional that he should self-isolate. So it doesn't make sense that the governor would intend for an applicant who doesn't meet this criteria in the order for an involuntary leave of absence to be able to meet the quit exceptions to ineligibility, which are more stringent than the leave of absence. So so that speaks to the fact that the governor did not intend to eliminate these substantive quit provisions. And then moving on to 2054, the subsequent order, the governor talks about workers needing protection from unsafe environments. It talks about the need for employers to engage in the interactive process to come up with appropriate accommodations for people who are vulnerable. And it also specifically mentions the good reason caused by the employer standard. And it keeps all of those requirements. They're all still there. You know, an employee still has to complain to the employer and allow the employer an opportunity to correct it. So the orders did not do away with the quit exceptions. Kind of as I said before, even if the court applies this substantial compliance test that the Murek court gave us, the evidence here shows that the relator does not substantially comply with the quit exceptions. And I'll kind of go through each of the two quit exceptions and what the evidence shows. So I'll start, kind of as an initial matter, the ULJ made findings of fact that the relator quit because he did not want to work during the pandemic, that it was not medically necessary for the relator to quit, and that the employer did not treat relator adversely. And all of these findings are supported by substantial evidence. So I'll start with the medical necessity exception. So there is no evidence that Hogan had or that relator had a serious illness that made it medically necessary to quit. When he did quit, he had not consulted with a doctor or talked to anybody at the employer about his medical concerns. And the evidence shows he did not inform the employer of his medical condition or request an accommodation before he quit.
So if I could jump in on that point, Ms. Phillips, because notifying the employer, those type of requirements do sound much more procedural in nature than substantive. And so as you're trying to apply Murek, and you're looking at the executive order to determine what portions of it may indicate that we should interpret it a certain way. There are substantive provisions, and then there are some that would be more procedural. How do you consider the requirement that somebody notify the employer, or that they submit some doctor's note or health provider's recommendation?
Sure. Like you mentioned, the requirement that it's medically necessary to quit, how do you apply substantial compliance to that? That's a little murky. Moving on to the procedural aspects that you mentioned, I would look to the test that the court gave us in Murek. They gave us some requirements for substantial compliance, which is you have to have a reasonable explanation for failing to strictly comply, and you have to take steps to comply with the statute. Those are two of the factors the court gave us. So looking at the informing the employer of your medical condition, did relator take any steps to inform the employer of his medical condition? The evidence does not have any such efforts. Did he make any steps to request an accommodation from the employer? The record does not have evidence of any steps that he took to request an accommodation or engage in that interactive process. So that's kind of one thing. Another is whether he provided an explanation for failing to strictly comply. He doesn't have an explanation for not strictly complying with those requirements in the medical necessity, not that I could find.
I mean, I you know, to be fair to the relator, his testimony or his statement that he has a health condition is evidence. And the explanation that I saw in the record for his non-compliance with the request for providing medical documentation is the cost to obtain that documentation. Now, whether the ULJ found that to be credible or credited that explanation is a different story, but I mean, to be fair to the relator, there was some evidence that falls into the categories where you're saying that no evidence was presented, right?
Well, the evidence that you're talking about is in those conversations that were held after March 23rd, the date of his quit. So that's kind of another issue in the party's briefs is the date of the quit. And the date of the quit is important in that, you know, the ULJ found that he quit on March 23rd. And that's, and our argument is that's supported by substantial evidence.
And Ms. Phillips, wouldn't we look to events that happened after the 23rd and consider whether or not if there's an undisputed fact that happens after the 23rd that indicates that he has not quit, and that if the ULJ doesn't consider that undisputed fact, wouldn't that be sufficient grounds for reversal? And the fact that I'm thinking of is the fact that he showed up to the work site in April, and if the ULJ doesn't address that fact, then is that by itself reversible under the substantial evidence test?
Okay, and I would say that the ULJ did address the conflict in evidence. You know, there was a conflict in evidence as far as whether he quit on the 23rd or not. And the ULJ addressed that in the credibility determination, and she made that finding that he quit on the 23rd. So to say she didn't consider his testimony, I think she did consider it, and I think she resolved that conflict in favor of the employer's testimony, which was, you know, he left. He didn't call us for a week. You know, that's, and she relied on that testimony.
So Ms. Phillips, does that mean there's an implied finding that he was rehired on April 22, briefly?
Yes, I think that was an implied finding that would have been maybe a refusal issue, because I think he didn't actually perform any work. So I think it was raised in the unemployment system as a refusal issue where he was offered additional work.
Well, he may not have actually removed his hammer from his tool belt, but he went to a work site and, I mean, he checked in, he went to a work site, he was prepared to begin working and then did not do so, turned around and returned and so on. But I'm just wondering, is there any evidence in the record that he was rehired after he quit?
Well, under the unemployment insurance law, that would be considered new employment. The ULJ's finding that he quit on the 23rd, I don't think she addresses in her finding the fact that he came back, but you know, under the statutory scheme, it would be an offer of employment or new employment at that point.
But was there evidence to support that? In other words, did the Mr. O'Loughlin testify that he was rehired, or how was it characterized in his testimony?
You know, I don't think he said that he was rehired. And maybe to more directly answer your question, it could be evidence that would perhaps cause another ULJ to find that he quit on April 22nd. You know, I mean, it is evidence that perhaps supports a finding that he did not quit on the 23rd, that he quit on April 22nd. So, I mean, that is evidence that maybe a different judge would have come out a different way on that issue of when he quit.
It seems both parties have characterized this in their briefs as that he came back to work. And I'm not sure if that is based on testimony. And I guess coming back to work might mean different things. Can you tell me anything about that, what the record says about that?
You know, I think the parties, I mean, the parties do treat it like he's coming back to work. I don't think it's treated like it's new employment as far as doing paperwork and orientation. I mean, I think they treat it like, okay, you're coming back to work now.
Didn't Mr. O'Loughlin even contact him and ask him to work after March? I think that's in the record too, right?
Well, I believe it was Mr. O'Loughlin contacting the relator, trying to get him to come back to work.
Right.
And that happened several times.
But that contact isn't in the record framed as we want to rehire you, but framed as there's work for you. I know you said you were going to go on unemployment, but there's work for you. Come in, right?
Yes.
You know, this discussion of the record kind of makes me curious about the fact that the Murak case and the factors that you're referring to, that came out after the ULJ considered the evidence or received evidence. Is that a reason for us to remand under whatever standard Murak sets forth, as opposed to this court deciding essentially facts and applying those facts to the new standard?
So your question is whether the court should remand in light of the Murak standard?
Well, to the extent that your argument is that you're applying factors from Murak to say that that the substantial compliance with the statute was achieved or proven, those are facts that the ULJ hasn't made. Those are facts that the parties didn't even argue. And so wouldn't it be better for this court to remand in light of the factors that you're pointing to than for us to make that decision in the first instance?
I see. Well, I don't know if a remand is appropriate because I'm not sure that it's clear that the substantial compliance applies to the substantive quit exceptions. You know, we apply the quit exceptions as they are in the statute. And as they are in the executive order, and that's how they were applied in this decision. So I don't think it's necessary to remand, but as I mentioned, it's not clear if the suspension of strict compliance alters the standard and what that new standard would be. But my argument is if the court does apply that substantial compliance argument, the record shows that he did not substantially comply on the date he quit, and we would argue, I know my time is up, I'll just say, we would also argue that even if the court reverses on that quit date and finds that he quit later in April, that it wouldn't be, it would be closer to substantial compliance because he did mention that medical issue, but it wouldn't meet substantial compliance at that point because he just didn't allow the employer the opportunity to correct that condition and he didn't engage in that conversation about the accommodation. So I see my time is up, so I'll go ahead and conclude and just request that the court affirm the ULJ's decision in this matter.
I'd like to clarify your position, the department's position on the application of MERAC, because I'm looking back at your brief and listening to your arguments. I'm not sure if you're, I mean, are you making the argument that MERAC is limited to procedural matters such as timing requirements and the such, but does not apply to substantive criteria? Is that your position?
Essentially, Deed has implemented MERAC for the appeal deadline, and that's the holding in MERAC. And Deed has also applied some substantial compliance to other procedural issues and deadline issues. We don't have any guidance or indication from the governor that we're to apply a different standard for these substantive quit provisions. And kind of as I argued, the orders actually keep those in place. So we have been applying the statute as it's written, except for what MERAC tells us to do, which is to allow for substantial compliance with the appeal deadlines.
So I don't mean to put words in your mouth. I'm just trying to understand what your position is. Your litigation position in this case then is that this court should not apply the executive order's suspension of strict compliance to the arguments made by Relator because his arguments are substantive in nature, not procedural. Is that your argument?
That's part of the argument. Yes,
I think you have a layered argument. You've argued, you know, even if, but I'm just wondering if that's your first position, or if I just want to understand.
Yes, I think I would answer that question. Yes, we're asking the court to affirm because we're applying the quid exceptions as they are written. We're not suspending any of their requirements. As far as there's another standard in the absence of strict compliance for these, you know, we're not clear on what that is. But we're arguing that the statutory exceptions are preserved in the governor's orders, that they are the current law, and that you have to meet the statutory requirements to be eligible for benefits. And nobody has told us that we are to change the statutory requirements or to apply different statutory requirements. So we just don't have anything, we don't have no other standard except for what the statute gives us.
I have one more related question. So again, since we have you just once standing up or appearing in front of us on the screen. So referring now to the later executive order -54, which you've quoted, you've quoted paragraph 6 on page 25 of your red brief. And this relates specifically to section 268.095 quit provisions. I mean, how would you characterize this paragraph, and how does this paragraph of the later executive order change the relevant provisions of executive order -05 for purposes of this case?
Right. I don't think it changes anything. I don't think 2005 changed the substantive law on quit exceptions. And this order is confirming that the good reason caused by the employer standard still stands. And it's just discussing it in terms of COVID precautions and COVID preparedness plans and the interactive discussions, but it doesn't change anything. If this good reason caused by the employer paragraph wasn't here, I think Deed would apply it in the same way and still require all of those statutory requirements. So I don't think it really changed anything. I think it's just clarifying how it applies in the COVID landscape.
So no change from executive order -05 and no change from pre-pandemic law?
No, not for the substantive quit exceptions.
Okay, it appears there are no.
Okay. Ms. Johnson, yes.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Ms. Phillips, again, I want to make sure I understand the argument you're making. I understand when it comes to the substantive standard, we talked about objective versus subjective. We talked about what compel. But to the extent you're also characterizing the notice requirements as substantive, is that what your argument is? That even those notice requirements for good cause exception or the medical exception, that those are substantive, not procedural?
I've been characterizing the quit exceptions as substantive law. I can see why you would characterize them as procedural, but my arguments today have presumed that the quit exceptions are substantive law.
Thank you, Ms. Phillips.
All right, thank you.
Counsel for later, Mr. Sonneman, you now have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. I think you are muted, Mr. Sonneman.
All too common a problem.
Yeah, I'm guilty too.
Yes, I'm on a school board and I do this regularly because we've been. Anyway, I'd like to start with with the 2054 order and the quote that is in the brief, the paragraph 6. I think it's important to recognize what that paragraph says. And it does, it first says, if the worker has complained to the employer about such adverse work conditions and given the employer a reasonable opportunity to correct such work conditions, that itself is an area where strict compliance versus substantial compliance has a substantial room for difference. I mean, substantial compliance could be a general discussion that I'm concerned about COVID, I'm fearful of COVID, I have health conditions that bother me, what do you think? Such discussions are in the record very generally, but if they occurred in the period preceding the 23rd, probably the week to 10 days preceding the 23rd. They were dismissed by the ULJ as insignificant or inconsequential. I think the inconsequential problem is exactly what we have here. If the department did not consider the concept of substantial compliance rather than strict compliance, it has failed to decide this case according to the law as it stood.
Mr. Soneman, if you're looking at paragraph 6 of that executive order, and you're saying that that changes the, we'll call them the notice requirements of the exceptions, doesn't that same order reiterate the standard of would compel a reasonable worker to quit?
And I think that that standard in those terms is, I'm going to be honest, fairly subjective. Very subjective.
Right. But my question is that still the standard? And if you're looking at that subsequent executive order to argue that that it tells us some new standard of substantial compliance with respect to notice requirements, don't you also have to, as you're standing here in front of this court, concede that the fact that it reiterates in the same language the previous exception language, that the subsequent executive order by referencing that language, leaves intact the standard that has always been applied under this exception, where you're looking at an objective person, the reasonable worker, and you're looking at, does it compel that reasonable worker to quit? And wouldn't you have to concede that if you're arguing now that the other part of that same sentence had some impact, then wouldn't the first part also have some impact?
I would argue that the concepts are there, but what reasonable means or what notice means changed. And an example of it is found as you go down through the paragraph, where it says an example of adverse work conditions include an employer's failure to develop or implement a COVID-19 preparedness plan. That wasn't in place in March. There's no evidence in the record that the employer had this preparedness plan.
Again, but Mr. Soneman, that essentially is using those examples. Those are examples of when an employer's policy or lack thereof would compel a reasonable person to quit. It's not changing the standard. It's an example of when that standard is met. And your argument on appeal is that the standard has changed. And now you're arguing that the second part of that same sentence supports your argument, ignoring that the first part seems to undercut it.
I apologize, I'm trying to follow. I in a way that I can answer properly. I think what I'm understanding it is that when confronted with this enormous problem of what was happening generally, the circumstances of evaluation needed to change. There had to be, if you will, substantial compliance, or essentially suspending strict compliance is what the order really says. And that is what I started looking for in the orders of the ULJ. And find grave concern in terms of, did it recognize and acknowledge that it was no longer required or allowed to use strict compliance. Once you get past strict compliance, that would have been a point for the ULJ to wrestle with the problem of what is substantial compliance. And there's a record here that is much more open to the interpretation that there was substantial compliance versus strict compliance. One of the key problems that jumps out is as you follow the process of how we dealt with COVID. There are things that come up later, and I'm pointedly the COVID preparedness plans that all employers were required to have. Some of that leads you back to where you kind of were at the beginning, and you want to be with the employer-employee relationship, but it didn't exist in March. And how we sort out the case in March, we can't say, well, we just applied these statutory standards strictly as we always have. The failure of the department to recognize that is really what the problem here is, that it didn't recognize at all. It was under the obligation to evaluate how to substantially or how to essentially suspend strict compliance. But as we now understand under Murich, which came along a year later and made clear substantial compliance rule applied to this problem of suspending strict compliance. And if we try and fit it all together in that time frame of March and April, and even a month or so later when the ULJ order comes out, it's clear there's one thing that should have been clear. Maybe we wouldn't be here. If the ULJ had wrestled with that problem of what happens after you suspend strict compliance, we might have a very different problem to deal with, but we don't. And it's clear the department's position remains that strict compliance with the substantive standards from the statute will remain unless told otherwise. And I submit that it is clear that it should have been clear to them then, and they should have applied the suspension of strict compliance. It is going to take a court order, apparently, to get them to suspend strict compliance. And from that point, we can solve the rest of the problems. But they've made clear where their position is, and it's wrong. And that's what we're asking you to hold.
I apologize. It appears there are no further questions for you, Mr. Sonneman, in which case the case is submitted. The court will issue its written opinion within 90 days. Thank you very much to both counsel for your excellent arguments.